Today I'm going to talk about HTML5, and it's time for some Slicker apps. Let's ask, who here is a back-end developer only? Who here is a front-end developer only? Who here has to touch the front-end and hates doing that? Who here is responsible for one of those servers that has lots of XSS holds because they thought they were a back-end developer and isn't one? Of course you wouldn't give up on that. So the thing about HTML, and let's go to full screen here, so we can actually show that HTML can be pretty as well. And we probably should shut down my Thunderbird as well, because that keeps going. Good. The problem is that Shut down all your computers now. No. The problem with web development is that it's always a big divide. It's always like you're a front-end developer or you're a back-end developer. And sadly enough, most of the time, we have to be something in the middle. And we're not really comfortable with both of these sides. There's a reason why people use JavaScript, and there's a reason why people use back-end development, because they don't want to learn about things that other people don't. And it's a scary world out there. The front-end is the great unknown. We don't know what browser people use. We can't tell people to use a certain browser. We really don't know how they set up their fonts, mix them up, and all these kind of things. So you write code for the unknown as a front-end developer. And for me, this was always the cool thing about front-end development, that I did not have control over it, and I had to write flexible and clever code to actually make everybody out there happy. On the back-end, on the other hand, we have control over the server to a degree, unless you work in an agency where the server is basically pushed upon you and like, yeah, you like IIS, right? I'm not saying anything. And the problem is then that JavaScript developers or CSS developers then start writing PHP and actually do things that are just bad and just do them because they're quickly and then go back to the back-end developers and tell them, I've done it in 5 minutes and you say it takes 3 days. There was this training site the other day that had a screencast of like PHP basics. And in 5 minutes, only 5 minute video, it taught you how you can get your server hacked really, really quickly. Because it didn't filter out any URLs, it stored passwords in a text file, unencrypted, and all these things that make it look fast but really not useful. So the problem is that in a market right now, it's always we need a developer. Our clients, our product managers don't know what we're doing. It's all magic. It's got something to do with computers. But we get money for that somehow. So what front end, back end, doesn't matter. You guys are, you're a programmer, you probably know CSS, WebGL, HTML5 video, and Perl and Ruby on Rails. And if not, we send you to a training and then you know it. So it's scary that we never get the chance to do that. And when you look at the future of interfaces right now, it's all about touch interfaces. It's all about the cool new things, all the tablets. When I hear like big tech blocks talking to me, everybody has a smartphone nowadays, there's no point supporting this old crap anymore. And it's just science fiction has taken over. And the interfaces is what people look at and what kind of funding you get as well. You can do amazing back-end server work and people are like, yeah, whatever, that's the cloud thing. Amazon does that as well, right? So if you want to impress people, the front-end is where it's at. And how do we achieve that? Because browsers suck. And they sucked for a long time. I mean, there's really bad implementations of things. So in the past, we had plugins. We had like Flash, we had Silverlight, we had Java applets, we had QuickTime VR, we had Vrml plugins. For years and years, we always plugged the internet to make it more effective, to make it more beautiful, to put 3D in it, and all these beautiful interfaces that out of the box it didn't have. The problem is that we made ourselves happy that way. Hey, we got plugins now. Now we made the web beautiful. That is actually a real patent. Does somebody got a patent for the backpatting machine? You can look it up. And we're like, great, well done. We fixed the web. Everybody has Flash. 99.57% of the people out there have Flash. That came to the Adobe website to look for Flash. Funnily enough, they had Flash installed. Interesting. So statistics always look at the source. And the problem is to me that plugins are patching the web. We have this like rocky road with the holes in it, and plugins are like a bit of gravel that we put in there and then hope that we can run smoothly over it. What I really want is the information superhighway, where basically we have a new layer of tarmac that allow us to write new technology in native code on the web, that people don't have to install a plugin and update a plugin and fix a plugin and secure fix a plugin. And we don't need that, because the browser should have the things that we wanted to have to build good applications with them, and they do, and it's called HTML5. And what's more important about this is not that we get excited about having a new language, nice, that we're having a new language, but that we actually use the existing infrastructure. The web is out there, and people have this really cool stuff. I mean, this thing is probably 5 times as fast as the first computer that I bought my first website on. And people have these things in their pockets. People have their machines with quad-core, octa-core, dual-core, and web technology cannot use that right now. And we should. We should use the infrastructure that people have. This is Folding at Home, which is a supercomputer distributed system from Stanford that looks at protein folding, which is one of the cases for Alzheimer's, one of the causes for Alzheimer's. And instead of building a massive computer system, they wrote a piece of software and allows people on PS3s and on computers to do the computation for them and send them back the data. And the same thing we can do with HTML5 and the web nowadays. We can use these cool new technologies that people have if we use the new technology. So first of all, HTML5 is a misnomer. HTML5 is not HTML4+1. It's a totally different thing. HTML5 includes JavaScript APIs and includes what is most important, information how a browser should actually render what HTML is. So in the specifications, it also defines what a browser is. In the old HTML specifications, it just said, like, this is what some user agent should do with it, and we hope that browsers did it right, and they didn't, and that's why we're a bit in a problem trying to upgrade the web. There's two players, there's the WhatWG and the W3C. The WhatWG I see is the research department. They come up with cool stuff that is not necessarily applicable, but is actually supported by several browsers, and they try it out. That's why you get these browser vendors and extra APIs. The W3C then takes what the WhatWG does and makes it palpable for people like enterprise-level software companies. So that's what the people look that want to have a stamp of approval on everything before they're allowed to use it. In the WhatWG, on the other hand, you actually can have random innovation that might go away later on. So it's much more dangerous to use what they do, but it's also cooler because there's new stuff happening. It's open. It's totally open. You view source it, you see what's going on. There's no compilation, there's nothing to do. You can take a look at the standard and wonder why something goes wrong. And if you're really bored, read the whole standard and then you find out why something happens the way it does. It's interoperable. It doesn't matter if it's a desktop, a mobile phone, a tablet, or a netbook. I've heard that people sometimes use that still. And it's backwards compatible, which is a big problem. Sometimes you cannot be as innovative as you want to be because it has to do something on old browsers as well. The benefits of using HTML5 is that it's an evolution of HTML. HTML was there to mark up text documents, to make a text document, a paragraph, a heading, a list. But we didn't have anything for applications. And in HTML5, we have applications. And XML has to die, I'm sorry. It's a pragmatic approach to web development as well. The HTML5 working group looked at what people are doing already and built the new HTML elements on top of what was in use already. Specifically, they looked at class names that people are using in their HTML and then made elements according to these class names, like header and footer and section and article. They didn't use the class name MSO normal because that actually is generated by Microsoft for you, which is good that we don't have that element. There's new and richer semantics. We have, as I said, we have new outlines, we have articles, we have sections, and it's a standard that defines the browsers as well, instead of just being a standard that hopes that browsers do it right. If you want to start with it, there's the HTML5 boilerplate. And that is a zip file that you can download, you can unpack it, and then you can start editing the index.html, and it does all the things that are annoying about HTML5 for you. Like, it fixes things for Internet Explorer 6, that you can style HTML5 elements that you can't out of the box. It gives you an Nginx conf file and an Apache conf file, so the videos come with the right HTTP header. And all these things that are actually sometimes annoying to do, you can start with one zip file and actually start playing with HTML. I actually took it in and I put it as a TextMate bundle, so in TextMate I just type HTML5 tab and I get my first HTML element and HTML page and start writing it. On top of HTML5, which is just that standard and a few APIs, we also have CSS going further. CSS was always there to style things, to make them beautiful, to make fonts, colors, paddings, layouts. Layouts were never properly defined in CSS. In the new CSS, we're actually working on that right now. We always had to hack layouts on the web. The good thing about CSS 3 now, all the new stuff that's coming out, is that we can actually get rid of a lot of images. In the past, we had images for rounded corners, we had gradient images, which were always a pain to optimize, because GIF as a data format doesn't like gradients, JPEG makes it blurry, then it's not the right color that goes into the background, and so on and so forth. Now with CSS3, we can generate gradients, we can use fonts, we can generate rounded corners, we can animate things, and everything is math-based. So if now I need a gradient that is 400 pixels, goes from blue to light blue, I can actually do that in CSS. And if the designer comes back to me and says, like, actually, it should be 500 pixels and not 200, then you can actually just change that number and you got a different gradient, rather than having to go to Photoshop, make that gradient, upload it to your server, and so on and so forth. It keeps all the visuals in one space. So a designer doesn't have to go to a JavaScript developer and say, like, we need that animation to be smooth. They can now do that in CSS themselves. And CSS is hardware accelerated, which is important if you go on tablets and on mobile phones and on iPhone devices, that actually makes them smoother than any JavaScript could ever be. And this is how easy it is. You have here the quick orange fox jumps over the lazy dog. And if you look at it, what it's doing, it's just mods animation, jump, linear, infinite, and then you have a keyframe there that defines your animation. It's actually rather simple to do. And you don't have to be a programmer to do it. It's all in your CSS, and you don't have to worry about it. There's a CSS3 dashboard on Mozilla that shows you all the cool things that CSS can do, like transformations, transitions. Media queries allows you to say, like, if the page is open on a tablet in portrait mode, give it that CSS. If it's in landscape mode, give it that CSS. If it's on a mobile phone that is only 480 pixels, give it that. And you got gradients, multiple backgrounds, and so on and so forth. So that's a great little page to see all the things that can happen in CSS3 now. A big thing for backend developers is that HTML forms make forms much, much better than they used to be. Forms were ridiculously simple. It's like input boxes, radio buttons, select boxes, and check boxes, and that's basically what we had. And we had to simulate a lot of stuff with that. What everybody always wanted is, like, can I offer something like 5 presets and people can type in whatever they want? A combo box that was even in Java Swing. We didn't have that on the web ever. Nowadays, we actually have that. HTML5 forms take the form idea of HTML much, much further. So we now have required attributes, for example, which means that the browser will not send the form off if the pattern, the regular expression pattern that is defined in the required attribute, next to the required attribute, is not fulfilled. This means you do your validation on your server, but you never ever have to write a JavaScript validation. And that was always the pain for any backend developer to have to do. Because then you had your rules somewhere in JavaScript, somewhere on the server, and then when the specs changed, they had to be fixed in 2 places. Nowadays, you can do that in your template in HTML, and the browser will not send it to you. You got maximum, minimum, and steps on number fields, for example, where you cannot get a 2.7 when only 5, 10, 15, and 20 is allowed. You got regular expression patterns and even spell check. Spell check, awesome. I mean, it would be the dead of YouTube, but it definitely is a good idea. And if you don't like what's going on there, if you don't like the original styling that's coming with the browser, there's also a validation API. And that's what is in JavaScript. So you can do what you can let the browser do its thing, but if you want to have your own warning boxes that look differently, you can actually use a validation API as well. You also have form submission control. You can dynamically change the encoding type, for example, or you can dynamically change the form action. So each button could actually change the form action and send that data to a different script on the back end, rather than having to have 5 different buttons with 5 different IDs and names in there that always clogged up our HTML. So a save button and a submit button could be in the same document, but send the data to different scripts on the server, which is very, very powerful for step-by-step things. Okay, ADM has to die. Good. We also have date pickers, number fields, email URL phones, and ranges. Ranges are sliders. These are not that amazing on a desktop, but on a mobile phone, for example, they're incredibly important. So when you take a number field, for example, it will automatically switch to the number keyboard, and I don't have to go through, like, extra keyboard and find the numbers and these kind of things. So in mobile devices, it's incredibly important to do these things. You've got a data list, which is an autocomplete with presets and typing in. You got meter progress and output when you do, like, step-by-step forms, which now we had to do with, like, 5 different scripts, and a keygen element in case you ever need to create a SSH keygen in the browser. Why that is in the spec, don't ask me. Interestingly enough, we've got file APIs, and that is pretty sweet as well. File uploads on the server in HTML were just a pain. You either had like one field per thing that you uploaded, and you had to wait for it. You never knew what's going on. You cannot have a progress bar, like how far is this thing uploaded. That's why we had to use Flash for that. But nowadays, we have file APIs in both Chrome and Firefox, and they work perfectly. You've got client-side file conversion. You've got packing before uploading. You've got drag and drop from the desktop. This, for example, is an example that we built. So you can drag an image into the page that's in a browser, and the image then is actually put into this other image, and you can start writing a caption for it. And once you've written the caption, it generates a JPEG from that whole thing and uploads it in the background already to Flickr or TwitPic or whatever API you wanted to call to. And now you can see you can share it here on Flickr, Facebook, and so on and so forth. Nothing here is server-side. This is all done in the browser. You can convert images in the browser, you can resize them, you can get the data out, you can change the colors, you can even do green screening in videos in the browser nowadays. And this is what these new APIs are about. Talking of video and green screening, HTML5 video comes with a few things. One of them is native browser controls. For accessibility, it was always a total pain to get Flash working because you cannot tap into a Flash control in Firefox or any other browser that is not IE. So all the keyboard controls we put in Flash movies only made sense when you could click inside it first. If you're a blind user and you cannot use a mouse and you don't know where to click, that was always impossible. So we had to find controls to play the video from outside in HTML. With HTML5, a video element is an element like anything else. You can style it any which way you want to. And it has a rich API to control the video from JavaScript. This one is an example where it's a bit meta, where I'm talking about encoding video in HTML5 for the right video codecs. And according to where I jump in the video, I show an iframe with the different content in there. And if you look at the source code of what I've done in the page, actually, I've got page data start and data end elements in there, or attributes in there, that says at second 4, start showing this iframe, and at second 38, hide this iframe. So this could be in a content management system. Anybody could actually edit that without having to do anything extra, and it's 5 lines of JavaScript nowadays. And this is how nice it is how video interacts with the rest of the page. We've written a framework called Popcorn that does this really easily. You just include the JavaScript and you get a full access API to, like, at that second do this, at that second do this, show these things for 5 seconds, then hide them, and so on and so forth. There's also a system there called Butter, which has a Flash-like interface that allows you to build videos connected with page elements and showing and hiding. There's a few issues with HTML5 video, of course. Most of them is patents again, like Microsoft and Apple think MPEG-4 is the future of the web because they're a part of the group that will get money when MPEG-4 is not free anymore. And Chrome and Firefox uses WebM as the format, which is annoying because us as publishers or as developers, we should not have to care about that. Sadly enough, we do right now. If you want to put a video online and every browser is supported, you have to have it in 4 different formats. Good news is if you upload to archive.org, for example, it automatically gets converted. Even better news, Vidly is a free service by encoding.com that you upload a video to and it converts it while you're uploading it into 20 different formats, and it supports over 2,000 different handsets out there. So if you send a Vidly URL to my mobile phone, the video comes in the right format for that phone. If you send it to a PlayStation, it comes in that format, and so on and so forth. Really, really powerful. Big problem for video publishers is that video content is open. There's no DRM. You cannot protect HTML5 video, which is like, for me it's great. I think it's pointless to try to protect video, but publishers think differently, so we have to think about that at the moment. Canvas is an API that's part of the HTML5 spec, which I always called actually an Etch-a-Sketch. You can paint inside the page, and you can wipe it. It's the same as an Etch-a-Sketch. And last time I showed it, somebody actually wrote an Etch-a-Sketch in Canvas and showed it to me. So you can actually paint with your cursor keys, and when you shake your laptop, it actually deletes it, which is really cool. But Canvas has a few features that I've never seen in any other thing. We all use Image Magic or GD in PHP to generate images. But it was always annoying because if you wanted to rotate something, for example, you had to calculate the corners, the edge points, accordingly. In Canvas, you don't need that because it has a dynamic coordinate system. This is all you need to do, for example, to have a canvas in the page and create a rectangle. You can create paths, you can create rectangles, you can create circles, and just lines as well, and dots, of course. And you see here that we have a rectangle that starts at 10:10 and is 50 by 50 pixels. That's the first thing that I always stumbled upon, because I always thought it's like 10:10 and 50:50 at the end points. But it's the start point and the dimensions of the rectangle. And when I wanted to shift that now in the middle of the of this canvas, in like Image Magic and things like that, I have to actually calculate that. I have like 160, 50:50. What I could do in Canvas is translate the canvas. So I can still paint the rectangle at 10:10, 50:50, but I translated the start origin point of the canvas to the middle of the canvas first. So this means when you need to shift things around, you never have to change your dimensions. You can have a path that you paint once. And shifting is one thing, but you can actually also rotate it. So you can rotate the coordinate system under your thing. So it's not like an etch-a-sketch, it's more like having different transparencies over an image and shift them around. So this one now rotates it here 45 degrees, and still my original dimensions stayed the same. And if you do this now for every single canvas element that you paint on there, you can do pretty wild things. You can even scale it. So you can say 0.7, 0.7 scale of that one. So if I wanted to do that with a fill rect here, there would be a lot of calculations I have to do. In Canvas itself, it's done with the API for me. And if you put this together, you can do things like that really easily. The source code of that one is available as well, and it took me like 2 hours to build it. So you can. It also shows how you can punish browsers nowadays. These are like particle systems. These are images that are getting rotated and made smaller while you actually do them. And this is running on this MacBook Air, and it didn't even start the fan yet. And that normally is the case when you do these kind of animations. So source code of that is available, and it's good fun to play with that. And it was only possible because the coordinate system shifts with every single one of those images. WebGL is the next big step. That's where people get really crazy nowadays. Like, ooh, we can do 3D in the browser. Like, was the win for so many years. Like, you watched Avatar and thought it was probably a good movie, and then you look in the script, it's actually Pocahontas meets the Smurfs. And really not fun. And even Justin Bieber was in 3D. That doesn't make it better either. But the good thing about WebGL is that it's OpenGL. It is OpenGL, and so it means we opened the web for millions and millions of developers who build games right now to actually not have to relearn something if they want to put things on the web. As a web developer, starting WebGL is harder. But we have a lot of people right now that don't laugh about the web anymore, but actually can start being part of it. And it's amazing for games. And again, it's hardware accelerated. So if you want to play with 3.js, the best thing to do is go to use the 3.js JavaScript library. And that one allows you to do something like that, for example, in a few lines of code. And it gives you the frames per second up there as a test as well to see what's going on. And so you don't have to do all the matrix transformations and learning about that yourself. That's all part of that library. And if you really know your stuff in OpenGL, that was one of the game competitions that we had in Mozilla. Somebody actually, this is really slow, because not because it was slow on the computer, but because when I record things on a Mac, it's actually rather slow. But this one is a full water simulation in pure JavaScript and WebGL. So you see that gravity is working, and the reflections are all working, and it looks incredibly natural. And that was done, source code is available of that one as well, because it's open stuff. And when you get really creepy, then you have a skin renderer right now, which is very lifelike. I mean, he's got like pimples and didn't shave like I didn't. And it's quite amazing what you can do in a browser right now. This one is available to me on a bit level. I can access every single pixel on that. I can change it around to any which way I want, which I could never do with QuickTime or with Flash before. Now, to get it less sexy but more interesting for us, storage. Cookies suck. Cookies are awful. The syntax is somebody just like vomited alphabet soup, and you get 4K per cookie, and it gets sent with every HTTP request that you do on your server, no matter if it's image or JavaScript or your HTML file or your PHP script that needs it. You can set cookies from JavaScript and from PHP or whatever other language you do on the server. They all get in their way. They were never fun. They were from the beginning stupid. Local storage, on the other hand, actually gives you a JavaScript interface for local storage. Instead of creating a text file somewhere randomly on the server, every domain gets 5 megabytes in the browser that actually is can be accessed with a simple key value store. You can do it as a session cookie or session storage that gets deleted when the tab is being closed, or as a local storage that next time you load the page, you got the full access to that. So it's simple key value, it's 5 megabytes of data across browsers, and it doesn't have an HTTP overhead at all because it's actually happening on the machine and not on the HTTP request. So it's wonderful for storing things that you don't need to care about on the server, but would be fun to have. You can even do it with images, you can even do it with interfaces. You can cache things in local storage. Talking about caching things, offline storage is a manifest file that tells you, please make these things available offline. When the computer goes offline, you can actually detect that with an API. Then actually data comes from your hard drive rather than loaded from the web. And there's nothing more annoying than having no data plan on your mobile phone, for example, because you click it refresh and like, okay, I just lost the map that I had earlier. For some reason, the maps here are actually in kanji when you're not online. So all the wonderful street names in Amsterdam were in Japanese, and I was like, okay, that's helpful. But with offline storage, I could store the maps that I did before and show you when you're offline and only refresh them when I go online again. History API is another interesting part that had to be fixed. When we came up with Ajax, we started reloading parts of the page, and we didn't change the URL, which is okay for somebody who realized what's going on there, but how many times have you reloaded the whole page when you got stuck in the Gmail interface just to go back to your inbox rather than to the email that you just read? So the History API allows you to change the URL of a document without reloading it. So I can bookmark it, I can send the link to my friends, I can actually go back and forth in the browser without having had any interaction with the server. So I can seed the history object of the browser with changes that I have. The best example for that is GitHub. On GitHub, when I click through a repository, in this case HTML media keys here, you see up there is the URL, which is probably not that readable. Well, actually not too bad. And when you click on it, the URL up there changes. But it hasn't reloaded. The whole page stayed the same. It only loaded the little part in that sliding tree thing there. So that means I can give people a fast interface. I only have to load the data that I need to load rather than the whole document every single time. And everybody's happy. And yeah, it's supported by browsers. It's not supported by Internet Explorer. But there are polyfills that you can do to actually make that one work as well. If you, SVG, as Scalable Vector Graphics, it's an older standard that is actually much, much older than HTML5 and allows you to do scalable vector graphics in the browser. That's by the name. And it's really a pain in the ass to do because it's XML-based and it's really hard to understand, and even PPK had problems earlier. So d3.js is a wonderful library, again on GitHub, again open source, that does these kind of visualizations from data tables. So in your backend script, just thread out a table in the page, give d3.js the ID of that table, and then it creates interactive maps and stuff for you in a more beautiful fashion than I could ever do. Raphael is another library that allows you to write SVG, much you like write others, so you can actually have an API that is much like Canvas, but it generates the SVG for you, which is much, much more painless than the other. And put these all together, and you got a wonderful thing like that. That is Chrome, for its birthday, released that evolution of the web website that uses SVG and uses all kind of storage and all kind of clever things out there, and it shows you how the browsers evolved over time and all the images there. And this uses Raphael, this uses all the libraries that I talked about, and it's a beautiful interaction that works with touch interfaces and everything out there. So the web is actually rather beautiful if you use it the right way. But we don't do it yet because we're afraid of it. But with all the things that I talked about today, we have a chance that we make it happen because people write code already. You don't have to write it from scratch. There's no point saying like, oh, if you use that technology, you can do it much faster when you look at GitHub and you find so many things that are already been done for you. So we are in the middle of the browser wars again. You see Firefox and Chrome and Internet Explorer here. And in the past, the browser wars were about like who can invent the most useless things that look shiny. Nowadays, the browser wars are actually who implements HTML5 the best. And the problem with that is that, again, the marketing departments of companies look for the shiny. So most of the demos you will see are actually WebGL and 3D stuff or interactive music videos, like the OK Go music video from Google, for example. Who's seen that? And like four pop-up windows where they jump from one window to another. Pop-up windows in 2011 is innovation. Anyways, what was really interesting about that one, and I talked to the Chrome team about this, we realized it must have not been done by them, because I have a Chromebook. The demo that is OK Go's demo, why Chrome is awesome to have a beautiful web, doesn't work on a Chromebook. It needs a MacBook Pro or actually a fast laptop to run. So it was quite funny to see that. So there's a lot of stuff going on, and we need you to actually play with forms. We need you to play with local storage and find bugs and file bugs, so we can actually support the things that make sense but don't look beautiful but make so much difference. I don't want to set cookies. I like local storage. I don't want to have a form where I need to write my own save button and submit button. It makes sense that my HTML allows me to do that. So the future is bright if we use it the right way. So a lot of annoying tasks can now be done by the client. We have these massively powerful machines that sit there idle most of the time because we just do everything on the server. We can do a lot of things on the client because we can test if the client is there and what it can do. What I haven't shown is, for example, a JavaScript called Modernizer that you can pop in the page and it then tells you with classes on the HTML element what of these features, what of these new features are actually supported. And that is really, really powerful. So you don't have to do the testing yourself. You just put the Modernizer thing in there and say, like, if web storage, then do the web storage thing. We've got client-side databases, as we've seen before. With Node.js, we can put JavaScript on the server and on the client and render the same widget on both sides. We just need to be jump over our own shadow and actually give the client side a chance. It doesn't replace the backend. It complements it. A lot of stuff you have to do as a backend developer, which is painting HTML, you shouldn't have to do. And with HTML5, we can do that. Servers can start breathing and do the things they are there for. And open free technology means constant innovation. If you get annoyed with HTML5, go on the mailing list and say this is crap. And you will probably get shot down the first three times, but then people will start listening to you and other people will chime in. There's nothing of this is behind closed doors. All of that is done in the open. So that's all I have. The slides are available. As you can see, they are HTML. You can download them as a zip. I'm Chris Heilman. The license is Creative Commons. The presentation is based on some slide system that somebody else had written. And if you go to the page itself and you don't want to see, you don't want to go through the slides, all you have to do is call the index.html, and then it actually is a simple HTML page. You can search and find for all the things that I talked about. So thank you very much.